Now, it's almost as if they have reinvented history for the modern age with a podcast that reaches millions of listeners around the world. Dominic Sambrook and Tom Holland are highly respected scholars with a string of book titles to their names. But they've achieved global fame as the presenters of the hit podcast, The Rest is History. This week, they've been in Sydney. Their Australian tour takes them to Melbourne, Adelaide and Brisbane. And I caught up with them for a chit-chat yesterday afternoon. Tom Holland, Dominic Sambrook. It's a great pleasure to have you on Saturday Extra.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks brilliant for having to be us. Here. Gentlemen, history seems to be having a bit of a moment. Historical novels are flying off the shelves. One of the biggest TV events of this year is Ken Burns' documentary on the American Revolution. You have one of the most successful podcasts on the planet. I wouldn't say there's a newfound fascination with history, but there seems to be a heightened fascination with history. Dominic, why do you think that is?
There are a couple of things. Number one is I think people are always fascinated by great stories and great characters. And actually, you know, with podcasting, you have a new medium. You know, we were new to podcasts. I'd never listened to a podcast before doing podcasts. And you can reach an audience, a younger audience, in a new way. And through storytelling, which podcasting is brilliantly suited to do. So I think that's one of the reasons. But I also think people are very conscious they're living through an age of tremendous change, of kind of seismic kind of global realignment, the war in Ukraine, Gaza, Trump, rise of China, going more broadly. And so people are interested in historical patterns, maybe in a way that during the 1990s, let's say, a sort of, you know, a more consensual, maybe more complacent time, the end of history. Mm. Now, history has restarted, so people want to know, you know, can we learn lessons from the past about where we're going? And I think that's part of it.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Francis Fukuyama's end of history. Tom, we're the same age. We were both born in 1968. Big, big historical year. Yeah, we're both old British guys. We're both undergraduates together. We're both postgraduates at the same time. At the time when Francis Fukuyama brought out this book, The End of History, did you think at the time, well, that's a bit of a bummer?
I had a friend who was doing a doctorate in 1989, and essentially it was on why the Berlin Wall was never going to fall. And his viva was about 3 days after the Berlin Wall duly fell.
Viva's your exam at the end of your PhD.
Yeah, and they passed him because the argument was so convincing. The fact that it wasn't actually true didn't really matter. So clearly he felt that it was terrible that history had ended. But of course it hasn't ended. And as Dominic said, it continues on. But I would just add that I think the fascination of history isn't necessarily related to its ability to explain the world that we live in now. I mean, the primal appeal of history is that it is the stories, the ability to go back in time to different places in the world to see what it is to be human through different eyes. I think that will always be fascinating, no matter what the political context of the age is. And I think that although we have done, on the podcast, we have done lots of episodes that kind of do hold maybe slightly distorted mirrors up to the present, we have also done a lot of episodes that don't have any direct relevance at all. It's just that, you know, the periods we're talking about and the narratives that we're telling are just inherently amazing.
I'm fascinated by the ways that you tell stories and tell history. You have fun. The storylines are ripping yarns. You even adopt these. There's a bit of amateur dramatics.
There
as
is. Well, yeah. Sometimes.
Of the very highest quality.
Of the very highest quality. Yeah. Is that the sweet spot? You don't sweep under the carpet the bad stuff in history, but at the same time, you don't sort of myopically focus on the bad stuff in history.
And I think that's something that we were very, it sounds odd to say, but we were fortunate with when we started. We started in late 2020, so COVID. So 2020, 2021, it's kind of the high point of the in the English-speaking world, the great sort of soul-searching about history and imperial history in particular. And, you know, people arguing about statues and all of that kind of thing. A lot of the conversation about history was therefore very moralistic and moralized and very anguished. You know, people were upset about it. Feelings were running high. Now, Tom and I never set out to be either, to use the jargon, woke or anti-woke at all. But we just wanted to tell the stories and give the listeners a little bit of space to make up their own minds. So when we're talking about the British Empire or Captain Cook or Columbus or whatever, we would see different perspectives. We wouldn't sort of hand down tablets from on high and preach to the audience and say, this is what you must believe. You know, that wasn't a deliberate strategy on our part. That was just instinct. And I think there was a segment of the audience that thought, yeah, we do want to make up our own minds. And also we want a bit of room for complexity rather than a very sort of simplistic moral lesson. So I think we were lucky, actually.
Yeah, what a time to launch the podcast, 2020. It was the summer of George Floyd, this African-American who was murdered in Minneapolis. That led to a lot of statue toppling. You know, you had school districts in America that were saying we shouldn't call our school Abraham Lincoln High School or George Washington High School. I mean, it was a really kind of electric moment historiographically.
I mean, I think that the one of the themes that we always pursue in The Rest Is History is the notion that moral judgments themselves are part of the flux of history, that they're not really stable, that they are always evolving, and that often they reflect power imbalances. So George Floyd, of course, is American and from an English-speaking country. So it's unsurprising that the predominant Anglophone power, namely the United States, should have had such a moral influence on countries like Australia and Britain, which speak the same language and, you know, share the same kind of religious and moral inheritance. But again, I mean, to reiterate, I think part of the fascination of history is that every period has had moral frameworks and assumptions, but it's just that depending on where and when you are, they can be incredibly different to ours. And always those moral frameworks are up against the propensity of humans to behave very badly. And often that tension, you know, it's there in every culture, every civilization, and it generates a kind of often very dark comedy. But the sense that people know what they should do and they then don't do it is a part, I think, of what makes us human, and therefore it makes history human when you see that.
It's a huge thing that we bring out in The Rest Is History, I think, is we love a hypocrite on The Rest Is History.
We
love people behaving very badly, having previously professed incredibly inspiring moral sentiments. And actually, it's one of the things that I often say to people. They say, well, isn't it shocking that the British did this or the French did this or whatever? And I always say, I mean, maybe it's shocking, but it's not surprising, because people tend to behave badly. And I think if you approach it as Tom and I do, which is to assume that by and large, people will behave badly if given the opportunity, then that gives you a very different perspective from one in which you're constantly disappointed, which I think is perhaps the greater trend among academics who, you know, when they're poring over the past, are constantly, there's a slight sense of disapproval maybe, that people have let themselves down in the past. Whereas we think, I mean, we often have people letting themselves down, but we are amused by it rather than horrified.
But I think also the sense, for instance, that it is wrong to go out and conquer people. I mean, that is a perspective that is very strong now. But if you go back to the period of Julius Caesar, whatever, Caesar conquers Gaul. He, it is said, kills a million Gauls, enslaves another million Gauls. And rather than feeling embarrassed about it, you know, when he celebrates his triumph through the streets of Rome, he boasts about it. Mm. So the Romans are not murdering Caesar because he's gone out and proved himself a brutal conqueror. They're doing it for very different reasons, which are, of course, by their own lights, incredibly moral. It's just that those standards of morality are different.
And it's fascinating you raise that, because something I think you both rail against is this idea of presentism, which is to judge the past by the moral standards of the present day.
Yeah, so I think inevitably when you write history, you're always standing in your own moment, of course. You know, if I write a book or Tom writes a book, we cannot escape our own subjectivity. But you can be aware of your subjectivity and you can place it in context, and you can be aware that the people at the time didn't necessarily share it. So when we, you know, we tell the story of, I don't know, let's say Peter the Great, the sort of master of Russia, the father of Russian imperialism and Russian expansion, you know, we can judge him and say what a terrible man Peter the Great was. You know, he inserted bellows into people as a sort of party game.
Bears, dwarves.
Yeah.
Loads of shenanigans with cakes.
Loads of mad
wheelbarrow races.
And also, you know, invading countries and all of this sort of thing.
Yeah, that too.
But to judge him, I mean, of course, there's always going to be an element of judging him from a 21st century perspective. But you don't understand Peter the Great and his world unless you put yourself in his shoes and the shoes of the people around him in a very violent world where the moral standards are not those of 21st century Britain or Australia. And it's just an act of imagination, I think, and an act of historic historical empathy to realize that your own position, as Tom says, is purely contingent. If I'd been born in Russia in 1700, I would think differently. And that wouldn't make me necessarily a worse person. It would make me a different person. And I think getting that across is a big part of the rest of history.
Tom, I wonder whether there are areas of history that you think this is too much trouble. I won't go there. This is contentious terrain. And a show like ours, which has this massive global audience, and an audience that sort of cuts across politics and cuts across generations, are there areas of history you think that might be off-putting to a large section of our audience?
I think you should never second guess what people are going to want, not least because we have so many different listeners from different parts of the world and different backgrounds and so on. So we couldn't possibly work out what they would all want. You obviously have to approach certain subjects of history with an awareness that there's an inherent sensitivity. And we have quite a kind of jaunty jingle with which the show begins. And so you do then think, well, I mean, how would we integrate a discussion about the Holocaust or about the slave trade or whatever into that? But it doesn't mean that we won't tackle those subjects. And in fact, just this fortnight, we have a series going out on the Nazi conquest of Western Europe that is part of a long-running series on the history of the Nazis. So right the way back to the kind, you know, before Hitler, the background from which he emerges. And it will go right the way up to, I suppose, the Nuremberg trials. And the story of fascist anti-Semitism and the escalating persecution of the Jews is part of that story. And so we will definitely be telling the story of the Holocaust. And we think very seriously how we should tailor that and how we should do it. But there is still an element of the ridiculous and the grotesque and the ludicrous about the Nazis. And it's about darkness and light, and it's about shade, and it's about stylistic and linguistic nuance, I suppose, that if you're doing an episode where you are plumbing the very worst of humanity, the most monstrous moral crimes, but maybe if you do another episode in that, the senior Nazis might be getting up to ludicrous spa-based shenanigans, which they are often doing, and cumulative, that then becomes quite comic. So it's a question of, I guess, of kind of trying to blend the various paints from your palette.
Yeah, the choice of topic determines the tone. So another good example, another series we've got coming up is Jack the Ripper. And, you know, we spent a lot of time chatting about how to handle the Jack the Ripper story. We wanted to do it properly. We wanted to use it as a window into 1880s London. Now, obviously, there's a true crime element to it, but we wanted to tell the stories of the women who were killed. And obviously, when you're doing that, they're horrific, horrific stories and very sad stories. You're not going to be cracking a joke every 5 minutes or something. You know, you're going to want to give it the seriousness and sensitivity it deserves. And that's dictated as much by the material as it is by our style. So I would hope that our style is sufficiently flexible that we can adapt. I mean, we actually did two episodes a couple of years ago about a bloke called Rudolf Werber, who escaped from Auschwitz and alerted the world to the horrors of the Holocaust. And we had a brilliant guest, Jonathan Friedland, who'd written a book about it. And, you know, that was spine-tingling, listening to him tell the story, because, you know, there was no banter, there's no jokes. It wasn't like a lot of other Rest Is History episodes, but it was just quietly kind of serious and devastating for that reason.
And just on the theme of finding humour where there is darkness, I mean, there's this wonderful phrase by Byron, and if I should laugh at any mortal thing, 'tis that I may not weep. And I think that's, you know, that's very much kind of part of where we're at with the podcast.
You're listening to ABC Radio National. This is Saturday Extra with Nick Bryant, and I'm talking to the Rest Is History boys, Tom Holland and Dominic Sambrook. You're both brilliant generalists, but you're both specialists too. I mean, Dominic, your PhD was in 1960s America. You wrote a brilliant book about Senator Eugene McCarthy, not to be mistaken with Senator Joe McCarthy.
Yeah.
Very different guy. That was when I first became aware of you. I read that book. It was brilliant. I wonder if the 60s... tell us anything about this particular historical moment in America.
Oh, that's a good question. And first of all, I should say, Nick, it's brilliant to finally meet the reader of that book. So thank you. No, I think there are similarities, actually, because I can remember when I was studying the 60s, when I was writing my PhD in the 1990s, it felt like ancient history. The passions had faded into the past. We were in a much more consensual age. You know, students weren't protesting and on the streets and whatnot. Campuses hadn't exploded, all of that. And there was a sense, actually, in America that the civil rights movement, you know, was over, and those racial questions had been solved. Of course, we know better now. But yes, I think certainly in when we started the show in 2020, the passions of the 60s felt very real and very raw, the racial passions in America, for example. Mm-hmm. And actually, we did a series recently about America in 1968, you know, the subject of effectively my PhD. And we were talking about people like Richard Nixon and George Wallace, presidential candidates in 1968, and the similarities between them and Donald Trump in rhetoric and style and appeal.
A criminal president, a demagogic guy who wanted to be president.
Yeah. Exactly. They really, really jumped off the page. So I do think, you know, if somebody writes the history of our age in the 23rd or 24th century, they will see this period probably as much more of a continuum than we do, as one thing rather than lots of different fragmented decades.
Yeah, absolutely. Tom, you're a historian of antiquity. I mean, Rome and the Roman Empire has been a big area of focus for you. Again, the same question. What do we learn from the Roman Empire in this particular moment?
Ever since the Roman Empire fell, people who lived under it were looking back at it and wondering what moral lessons could be learnt from it. They were keen to restore it. The ambition to bring the Roman Empire back in some form has motivated European leaders probably right the way up to the time of Mussolini and Hitler, who effectively immolated that tradition. But I think that the great fascination of studying the Romans is that they are fantastically alien. They are interesting more for the reasons they're not like us and that they are. They are sufficiently similar to us, perhaps, that studying Rome has something of science fiction. But once you've thought yourself into the Roman mindset, you see that even though Roman civilization sustained slavery and blood sports and imperial conquest, they still have an incredibly burning sense of morality, and that the course of Roman history, which sees a republican system of government replaced by an autocratic system of government, is a kind of great moral tragedy as well as a political tragedy. And I find it really moving. I mean, I find seeing the world through Roman eyes, it makes me aware of how contingent, I guess, my own perspectives and values are.
Let's talk about Australia. Quite brave for two Englishmen to tour Australia at the same time as the English cricket team, who were getting a bit of a hard time. And Tom, I share your pain. You were in Perth last weekend.
Yeah, I was, and I'd kind of booked up 4 days, obviously.
That was optimistic.
Yeah, you know, 2 days after the test match was over, I was at the Museum of the Mint in Perth. Kind of thinking, oh, no, not to cast any shade on the Museum of the Mint in Perth. I mean, it was epic, and it was brutal, and the deeds that were performed there will be sung down the ages. But it was kind of like the Iliad, you know, that if you're a Trojan, you don't really want to sit and watch the Trojan War. And that's kind of what it felt like, to be honest.
An epic historical take on the first test in Perth. One of the things I love about Australia is that Australians don't take themselves particularly seriously. I think you've seen that, haven't you? The fun that you have with Australian audiences. But I think a corollary of that is Australians don't necessarily take Australia that seriously. And I think that extends to its history. There's a lot of people in Australia who don't think Australia's got much of a history. There's no Gettysburg, there's no Revolutionary War. You know, they look at history and they think it's a little bit kind of threadbare. I wonder what your sense is.
No, I mean, we wouldn't agree with that at all, would we, Tom?
Yeah, I'd push back against
it. We did one of the great moments in world history, which a lot of your listeners will know, which is when the Australian Prime Minister, Billy McMahon, in the early 1970s, went for an interview, I believe, at ABC, and walked out having tried to steal a tape recorder. And he was stopped on the way out, and he said, no, this is my tape recorder. Well, that's exactly how he spoke, by the way.
People love your Australian accent,
of course, by the way. They do. They love it. And actually, you know, the people who stopped the security guard order said, no, look, and turned it over, and embossed on the back was property of ABC Radio. And so we enjoyed telling that story in our deeply researched series.
On Australian Prime Minister.
Australian Prime Ministers, of course, we gave the...
There's been a lot of them recently. It's been sort of hard to keep track. Yeah.
So Julia Gillard is a listener to the...
Yeah, she's a listener.
Issue,
yeah.
Isn't she? And you've had dealings with Tony Abbott, Tom.
Tony Abbott sent me his new book.
He's just written a book. I'm reading it at the moment.
Yeah, I think it's very good. He's the guy who... I talked about it yesterday when we were in the Sydney Opera House. And he has this great story about Robert Cecil, the future Lord Salisbury, who become Prime Minister actually during the time of the Jack the Ripper murders. But he goes out as a young man to investigate the Australian gold fields, and he's wearing this white top hat, and one of the diggers picks up a lump of clay and knocks it off. And that seems very portentous in terms of, you know, the evolution of Anglo-Australia.
Right. Who says Australia doesn't have a history? Come on.
And that's a really interesting bit of the book that proves the point, really. I mean, a lot of people look at Australian history and think, well, they just sort of copied the Brits. But actually, Australia developed a very distinctive form of democracy, which Tony Abbott's book actually gets into. Yeah.
A fabulously rich country in the 19th century.
The gold rush,
And the sense in which it's mapping and in some ways kind of exceeding what's going on in the United States at the same time, I think is really intriguing.
And the way we tell history in Britain tends to be very, you know, we're focused, of course, on our own behaviour and British people. But the story of the World Wars, which is so essential now to British national identity, the Australian component of that is obviously enormous. So you think of Gallipoli, for example, but then you think of the, you know, Australian or indeed New Zealand airmen in the Battle of Britain, you know, the contribution that Australians made to the Second World War.
Singapore, the fall of Singapore.
Not as well known in Britain as it should be, actually, but arguably the single, you know, the moment, the death knell in the disintegration of the British Empire, and obviously a massive moment for Australians and their sense of where they were in the world and where their future lay.
And you haven't even brought up the bombing of Darwin.
No, exactly.
A lot of Australians forget that too.
Submarines in Sydney Harbour.
Yeah. Academic scholarship can be a very lonely business. You squirrel yourselves away in the archive, in the libraries. Often you don't talk to people all day. So how is it to step out on stage at somewhere like the Sydney Opera House, where you've got thousands of people?
Mad.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, there was a moment, last night we were at the Sydney Opera House, and there was a moment, I think it was the first, we both agree, it was the first time we genuinely
cracked up on stage,
where we were talking about Savonarola, the sort of mad monk who tried to reform Florence in the 1490s and ended up as the master of Florence and had the bonfire of the vanities.
Before being put to death.
Yeah, before being burned himself.
Yeah.
And Tom does an excellent Savonarola. He does Savonarola.
Very rasping voice. He's more like that.
And there was a moment.
Obviously with an Italian accent.
Exactly. There was a moment on stage where, you know, there was 1,500 people or whatever, and we were talking about what would Savonarola make of Australia now, 21st century Australia? And we were ventriloquizing Savonarola, talking about barbecues.
And shorts. Revolting.
And you're absolutely right. You know, when I was doing my PhD, if you said to me, one day you'll be at the Sydney Opera House doing Savonarola's voice, talking about
barbecues.
About barbecues. You know, it would seem like some mad fever dream. And in fact, the whole podcast seems like a bit of a mad fever dream, because when we started, I remember saying to somebody, you know, we'll just be shouting into the void. No one's going to listen. And we're just going to witter. Tom rang me up and said, do you want to do it? And he said the line that will basically be engraved on my tombstone, which is, it will be no work, which was totally untrue. It's just wonderful to go from academic scholarship, where no one cares, to a world in which people do care and people are really invested in the stories we're telling. I mean, that's absolutely humbling for us.
I think also what we find, when we're going around Australia and we get questions from the audience, is we can tell the stories we've been doing on the podcast and the characters, how they have impacted on people. And it's like they're talking about figures from soap operas or something like that. And suddenly, you know, Lady Hamilton or whatever is a live figure and being talked about on a stage in a way that she probably hasn't been for a fair while, I would think.
Let me tell you about something that happened to me this morning. I went to a school and I was talking about American history. You know, 250 years of American history makes sense of Donald Trump, if you look at history in a slightly different way. And at the end of it, I said, you know what, this is a big history day for me today. I'm meeting the guys who do the rest is history. This was a class of 15-year-olds. And I asked them, anybody listen? More than half of them put their hands up.
Oh, the future of Australia is secure.
Yeah. I've never said a bad word about Australia, and I never will.
Yeah, I don't mind if they win 5-0 in the Ashes. Good on them.
Tom Holland, Dominic Sambrook, it's been a great pleasure to talk to you on Saturday Extra. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And the history of this continent, of course, goes back millennia, 65 millennia. There is so much history to talk about. And you can still hear and see the Rest is History boys on Sunday in Melbourne, on Tuesday in Adelaide. And they're finishing their tour on Friday at the Concert Hall in Brisbane, and a number of people on the text line are saying, we want them in Canberra and Tasmania as well.
Listen to more great stories that take you beyond the headlines. Ask your smart speaker to play ABC RN.